23 CR State v. Prohoda. And Mr. K, Timothy K, represents Mr. Prohoda.
Morning, Justices. Police and Court. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Prohoda. My associate, Mr. Ron Sonderhaus, is also present, and he's worked on the briefs. And this case essentially revolves around a very serious set of circumstances that occurred way back in August 17, 1975. Mr. Prohoda and three other co-defendants were involved in some very serious criminal activity. After they engaged in activity, they were arrested, there was a trial, and eventually they were convicted of five counts. In February 11th of 76, a sentencing was imposed by Judge Victor Manning of Milwaukee County some 20 years ago. And on the first count, there was a conviction for first-degree murder, which resulted in a life sentence. And counts 2 through 5 were basically the armed robbery while masked matters, which resulted in 35 years being imposed, 30 years for the armed part, 5 years for the masked part. The reason why we're here is because there was a discrepancy back then as to what the judge said at the time of sentencing and in his transcripts. What he said was, and the issue that brings us here is that count 5, the 30-year sentence, is consecutive to count 2. Because of the enhancers, the way the math works out is that that sentence would turn out to be a life sentence plus 70 years. What the clerks drafted, or somebody drafted in the written judgment of conviction some 20 years ago, was that count 5 was consecutive to count 1. That effect was that that would be a life sentence plus 40 years. So time goes on, and apparently Mr. Prohoda and the Department of Corrections work under the assumption of the judgment of conviction entered in 1976. That is the case because apparently there were some parole hearings that were initiated back in 1984. That can only happen if, under their guidelines and the administrative code provisions, if they calculate the sentence to be life plus 40. In other words, you could be eligible for parole hearings by August of 93. If you use a life plus 70 analysis, you're not eligible for parole hearings until year 2001. So, even though that is not something that's cited into the brief, that's something that is referred to in the Department of Corrections memo dated November of 97, and they referred to this incident or to the discrepancy between the transcript and the judgment of conviction. It's a memo from Ms. Carol Briones to a clerk, Sandy Bostwick. The memo is a handwritten memo. It's a fairly small document, and it clearly, the Department of Corrections person is clearly referring to the discrepancy between the transcript and the judgment and wants clarification as to which is correct. Now, the important point is that memo, from what we can tell, is not reviewed by a judge, not given to a judge, there's no notice of hearing, and there's no interplay between the judge in the clerk's office, as far as we can tell. On the case minutes, which we attached in our appendix, and which is part of the record, there's an indication that the judgment of conviction was changed by, quote, SB, which I take to mean the clerk, Sandy Bostwick. So it appears what happens is that the Department of Corrections writes a memo, the employee from the department writes a memo to clerk in Milwaukee County. The clerk, for whatever reason, changes the judgment of conviction on her own initials, and amended judgment of conviction then is issued, drafted, and sent out without any hearing. The change in the judgment of conviction now reflected the sentencing transcript to read that count 5 was consecutive to count 2, so the effect was life plus 7. Now, this is all done some 21 years after the fact, and Mr. Prohoda then sees notice of this in 1998. There's a motion to extend time limits, which were granted. We were appointed and filed a post-conviction motion which was summarily denied by, I believe, Judge Lamless 5 days later after receipt. Again, without a hearing, without notice, without even receiving a brief from the district attorney's office, and summarily denied that request. Court of Appeals affirmed, and Supreme Court took this case on the issue of plain error. We contend that plain error was apparent here. It is incorrect for a clerk, not a judge, to change a judgment of conviction from life plus 40 to life plus 70, thereby adding 30 years without hearing or notice to the defendant. Just the sound of that, of adding 30 years by some administrative action by employees, does not sit well with attorneys and the judicial system.
Well, it didn't really add 30 years because it's conceded the actual sentence was life plus 70, right?
And
so there was no adding of years by a mere clerk.
Well, back in the transcript, back in 76, that's what it said. But he operated under the impression for the last 20 years that it was life plus 40.
What is your position as to what the actual sentence was?
Well, there's cases that indicate that the oral pronouncement of the time of sentencing controls over the written format or the written judgment of conviction. So that would seem to be the case, but I'm proposing that under 90103, that even that change that had gone on for 20 years, unnoticed by the department, unnoticed by the defendant, they operated under that scenario that he could become eligible for parole, not release, I mean, just eligible for parole, and by the fact that he wasn't notified or had a chance to be heard in front of a judge as to whether that was a correct change or incorrect change, that's plain error.
Okay, that's a separate issue, though. You're conceding the actual sentence was life plus 70,
yes.
And so what the clerk did in this case, regardless of whether the clerk should have done it or a judge should have done it or whether there should have been a hearing and a right to be heard, what the clerk did in this case didn't add anything to the sentence.
Correct.
Okay. Now, did it make any difference to him? Practically, whether it was life plus 20, 30, 40, 70, when does he get out?
He's eligible for parole hearings. 93, it doesn't mean that if it's life plus 40, he's eligible for hearings in 93, he's not going to get out until whenever they let him out.
When is he eligible for hearing in life plus
70?
70.
According to my calculations, it was 2001.
Okay, so it didn't matter theoretically.
Right.
Mr. Kay, if you concede that the case law indeed indicates that the oral pronouncement controls over the written judgment of conviction and sentence to confinement, then even if this was error not to bring it before a judge first, but to bring it first to the clerk and have the clerk amend it, isn't that a harmless error situation?
I don't believe that it would be harmless because the mere fact that so much time has gone by, if you look at the harmless analogy, you'd have to look under 805.18 and those cases, I think the Bostwick case, indicate that if there's a reasonable likelihood of success, that should not occur. And we suggest that because the action of the clerk doing this administrative task 21 years after the fact, 20 years after the statute of limitations, that it is probable that a judge could say, no, I'm not going to let this stand.
Well, let's say that it did come before a judge. Let's say that there was this matter was brought to Judge Lamalis in the first instance, and she decided to send out notice to your client. She decided to hold a hearing, have him brought in from the correctional institution. If the oral pronouncement controls, Is there any question that what would have happened is there would have been an amended judgment of conviction and sentence to confinement as a result of that hearing?
If you
what power would, let me ask it another way, what power would the judge have to say, oh, what the heck, I'll just make it 40 years instead of 70 years? Judge can't do that.
In this case, I think the judge could, if he listened to equitable considerations and by the lapse
have,
of time.
Do you have any authority for that?
I believe I cited it in my brief to the argument of 805.18 mistakes by clerks that no judgment shall be set aside. 805.18 some 2, no judgment shall be set aside unless the error or proceeding affects a substantial right of that person, and the court has an opportunity to review that. I just take from a basic definition, a basic assumption, that a clerk administratively adding 30 years to a corrected judgment of conviction is affecting a substantial right.
Let me approach this another way. My understanding is that a trial court can only modify a sentence in very limited circumstances. One of the circumstances would be if there's a new factor which would justify the modification of the sentence. The other basically would be circumstances where the judge had abused his or her discretion in the first instance and recognizes that and admits that and could then modify the sentence. That very seldom happens, but that's a possibility. Now, is there anything here that shows that this is a new factor situation under our definition of new factor?
Not under that analysis.
And is there anything here that shows that Judge Mannion, in the first instance, abused his discretion in pronouncing the sentence?
No.
It seems that if your answer is no, as I think it has to be, and that the there was a clerical error in the judgment, in the sentence, then it seems that the issue before the court should be, how do you correct this error? Do you correct it by the clerk doing it? Or do you correct the error by insisting that the judge do it? Your position, I gather, is the judge has to do it.
Correct.
That this is very serious, changing a sentence. I mean, even if you increase that sentence by 1 year, you're increasing the time spent in prison. And one day to the person spending it behind bars is a significant right. So that's your position. It had to be done by the judge.
Correct.
Okay, now,
with a hearing.
Correct.
Suppose that we agree with you. We say the judges should do this clerical correction, not a clerk. And it should be done giving a notice to the defendant and an opportunity to be heard. Now, did your client get notice here?
No.
Well, but your client found out about it.
Right. After they made the change, he receives a little notification from the DOC. It says count five is consecutive to two.
Okay, so now the client is notified. And what does the client do?
Well, he complains, and we become appointed, and we file a post-conviction motion.
And you have a hearing?
No.
You didn't have a hearing?
No.
But you filed papers.
Yes.
And the court, on the basis of the papers, decided you didn't have a right here, or that you were going to lose this.
Correct.
Well, why can't the court say that's good enough? Post-change is good enough. And then you don't have to have a hearing. There are many instances in our proceeding where looking at the papers by themselves, the judge makes, the trial judge makes a decision. Even courts of appeal and the Supreme Court make a decision that it's so clear on the face of the papers that one party is right or the other wrong, that you don't have to be heard. And why couldn't the judge here, Judge LaMalle, say, looking at these papers, the oral statement in the transcript of the sentence takes precedent under the cases you've cited. There's no challenge to this transcript. Therefore, this judgment, a sentence has to be corrected. It was corrected. You lose. And so what you do is you can either have pre-correction proceeding or post-correction proceeding. Doesn't make much difference. One is as good as the other. So you got full due process, all the process you're doing. What's the matter with that argument?
Well, assuming that the judge did make those findings, the trial judge, of that there was an oral pronouncement that took precedent, and it doesn't matter, regardless, I'm going to rule this way anyway, but we don't know that, because there wasn't a hearing. And that's why we have the rules that provide that defendants must be present for certain hearings, and that's why we play the game. That's why there is a right to have a hearing, because you never know what's going to happen until you've gone through the hearing.
Well, the judge denied your motion, your post-conviction motion. So why is that not good enough?
Well, I believe that when the judge did that without a hearing in notice, that actually in the mind of Mr. Brijoda, that he was, without him being there, the sentence was being imposed upon him of another 30 years, even though we all understand that way back in 1976, the way the judge may have said it, one could construe that to be that he was notified back then. But I got to tell you, when you look at that, those old judgment of convictions, there's no way anybody sitting there in court, especially a defendant who's gone through a several-day jury trial and judge is going on about consecutive concurrent, is going to figure out life in 40 and life in 70. There's just no way. If he could figure that out, I think he'd be an outstanding individual. But in his mind, when Judge Lamelis denied his hearing, or denied the post-conviction motion, in effect, it imposed a sentence of another 30 years. And under 97104, sub 1G, the defendant needs to be present in court for the pronouncement of a judgment or imposition of a sentence, i.e. the second judgment of conviction is the imposition of a sentence.
So you're saying he had to be there?
Yes.
Even if she was going to say, as she wrote here, this is in the appendix, your appendix, that she recites, you filed a pre-sentence motion, that she filed a motion for post-conviction relief. She says that he entered a plea of guilty and he was found guilty. And that there's no basis then to say he was never judged guilty on count two. You don't take umbrage at that, do you?
No, and I apologize for that. That argument was based upon our misbriefing the issue that he was not found guilty of count two, but later on we found out that he apparently pled to count two. So.
All right, so then he didn't have to be present for that.
Correct.
Okay. Then the judge says that Perota also takes umbrage with the correction made by the clerk's office. And then the judge says he submitted it shouldn't have been made, that was by mistake. And then the judge says the judgment conviction erroneously reflected that the sentence imposed count five ran consecutive. The judgment roll and sentencing manuscript both indicate that the sentence in five ran consecutive to the sentence imposed to count two. entitled to a clerical error without notice. That's the line you object to?
Correct.
So you think that that the clerk's office doesn't have the ability to correct the clerical error?
Well, I would...
Because they don't, the clerk office doesn't give notice.
Right. I guess we will debate on what is a clerical error.
Right.
I mean, if it's a small typo or something like...
It's a big typo.
Yeah, but 30 years is a large typo.
That's right. That's right. I recognize that. But the what is given here is your argument would be the same whether it was 3 or 10 years. I mean, it should be. You should be arguing that increasing the sentence of a defendant, no matter how many days in effect or years, without the court doing it, is a no-no.
But the 30 years just shocks conscience.
Okay, but you agree that
yes.
He was given 30. You
yes.
Just want defendant to have a hearing with notice.
Correct.
And post notice after that is not good enough.
Correct.
Counsel, I think about 4 years ago we had the case of State versus Bentley out of Milwaukee, which I think stood for the proposition that the court doesn't have to give a post-conviction hearing, a post-conviction motion. If the court can decide it, there's no issue, and the court can decide it just from the documents. Why do you need a hearing then?
Well, I think, and I haven't read the case, but I think that might be one of the statutes under 974-06 post-conviction type motion. I think there's a provision in there for the court to do that. I think it's subsection 5 or 6. But in this case, it's such a substantial change and such a substantive right that he is expecting to lose to have 30 years tacked on. I think, in all fairness, he should have been brought before a trial judge and explained this, and he could have had a chance to object or clarify or whatever. I don't know.
If the matter had been sent initially to the judge and the judge made the change without hearing, and then you brought a motion like you did here, except the facts are that the judge did it without hearing, do you have any basis for appeal of that fact situation?
Yes, I think I cited in a brief the Siegel versus State case, and that was a case where a judge restated in a judgment conviction what the oral pronouncement was. Apparently that judge did it after the after the fact, or after he had, the defendant had gone to the prison system, and it was subsequently ruled that that procedure was void as a matter of law because the defendant was not brought back before him. So I'm suggesting that even though when we go outside, that maybe the trial judge would have done as we think could have happened here at the other 30 years on. We don't know, but there's supposed to be some due process where the person has a chance to appear before the judge and at least hear the imposition from the judge. And if all it is just a means to an end, maybe the system is better off because the defendant hears it from a judge versus some little memo from a Department of Corrections person.
Counsel, you disagree with the statement that there was nothing that the judge could have done, Judge Lavalis, except to follow the original sentence. Do you agree or disagree with that?
At this point, I agree.
Okay. So the hearing you're asking for is just more of a public consideration and obviously to your client a private one that you would like have him or her come before the judge and just hear it from somebody sitting on the bench rather than just notice that they did.
Correct.
And that's more or less what you're asking for.
Well, correct. And in the world of defense lawyers, you know, whenever you get back in front of a circuit court judge, you know, he may want to bring up other motions or pursue other motions to modify. Whatever he wants to do on that end would be something else. But I think the...
I don't think the judge would have been... Well, could the judge have considered other motion to modify a sentence, as Justice Crouch was pointing out, would be, that's it. That's what the law of the state of Wisconsin is, and that's all that would be allowed to be argued.
Right. At this point, we cannot find anything that was incorrect with that original pronouncement of judgment. I think the case of Bostwick also stands, Bostwick versus Van Kluck, that these administrative clerical errors should be made in the court or by the court with regard to equitable considerations. So whatever the defendant wants to propose in equity would be remain to be seen. My time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Kay. If there are no further questions, Attorney William C. Walford, Assistant Attorney General, State of Wisconsin.
And please, the court. It's the state's position that the written judgment of conviction in this case could be corrected to reflect the actual sentence imposed against the defendant at sentencing. In this case, the oral pronouncement of sentence was unambiguous. Written judgment of conviction could be corrected to make it clearly conform to the actual oral sentence pronounced. It is long been the rule in this state that a court has the power to correct clerical errors at any time. Federal Rule 36 and many state rules also provide for correction of clerical errors at any time. The defendant has contended that the correction was barred by 893.40 of the Wisconsin statutes. He hasn't specifically addressed that in his argument. We would just say that this correction of a clerical error was not an action upon a judgment within the meaning of that statute. It was just the correction of a clerical error. That statute deals with civil actions. This was not a civil action. It was not, the correction was not barred by the doctrine of latches. He has also argued this. Latches is an equitable defense to an action. There was no action here. This was, once again, just the correction of a clerical error. One of the elements that is missing from a latches defense is quite relevant because of something that has been discussed in the argument already. We contend the defendant didn't lack knowledge that the other party would assert the right which is being asserted. The defendant was present at sentencing. He heard the sentence imposed. And I've indicated in my brief that over the years, the defendant filed many briefs and motions where he indicated that he knew that the term was life plus 70 years. So to say that he needed to go before a judge to hear that it was life plus 70 years, that was the purpose of having this hearing, doesn't really make a lot of sense because...
But Mr. Walford, the issue might be whether this defendant had to go to a judge or any defendant that needs a correction has to go before a judge, and you might have another defendant who spent all this time thinking he got life plus 40 because he had it pinned to the wall.
I understand. And
so let's take that defendant for the moment, the defendant who thinks he's got life plus 40, erroneously thinks that, but thinks it nonetheless. So then all of a sudden he gets a piece of paper to be pinned to the wall saying it's really life plus 70. And he objects. Do you think that the clerk of court has authority to change this judgment? Judgment signed by whom? The sentence.
In this particular case, the judgment of conviction was signed by the clerk.
On order of the judge.
On order of the judge.
Okay. Now there's no order of the judge saying, change this piece of paper, right? So the clerk changes the piece of paper. Where does the clerk have authority, statutory authority otherwise, to change the judgment?
Well, the position we've taken in the brief is that the court should have done it rather than the clerk.
That's what I'm trying to get out.
We say it was harmless error, but in looking at the case law and looking at the federal rules and the state rules, it talks about the court doing this, not the clerk. Certainly the clerk can act on the direction of the court, but we think that it would have been appropriate for the court to consider this issue first. Now, you have a lot of different situations. I mean, you have clerical errors where someone's middle initial is wrong. And that's, you know, maybe a different situation, but where you have a situation where the term of the sentence could be affected, certainly we think that the court should be making those.
So now we all agree on the law that the clerk should have done it. So how does our opinion, I'm sorry, that the judge should have done it. So how does our opinion read?
Well, I think in this particular...
What opinion should we set forth?
I think our position in this case is that although the court should have done it, that it was harmless error in this case because after the fact, the defendant received notice of the correction. There was a post-conviction motion filed. A court reviewed the issue and determined that it was just the correction of a clerical error, and therefore the oral pronouncement of sentence is the one that governs and it should stand.
So the opinion will say clerk has no authority, court has authority only to change the sentence part of the conviction. That should the clerk do it, then the process is that you bring a post-conviction motion in the trial court, and the trial judge hears it then, and that's good enough.
I think it is. Now, there are instances where there is need for an evidentiary hearing for fact-finding clerical errors that can't be determined from the record. This is one that could be determined from the record itself.
So we have to modify the opinion I wrote to say where the judge can determine from the record that the modification was correct, no need for hearing or notice, or prior notice.
The federal rules suggest that notice is preferred in these types of cases, but it isn't a grounds to overturn the correction.
What is the remedy? I mean, suppose we don't agree with you and we don't say harmless error. We say, look, we say harmless error, then they're always going to do it this way. There's no need to do it the other way because it's harmless error. So if we agree with the, we say, gee, we can't do that. We've got to draw the line and say, did it wrong, do it again. So what's the remedy here?
Well, the defendant would be exactly the same situation as they are now. If you determine it wasn't harmless error, they would have to go back and make the correction before the court, I guess, with the notice, and the defendant could make any argument that he wanted to make, but I think the bottom line would be the same because the oral pronouncement was unambiguous and it controlled.
Counsel, the trial court indicated that in the last sentence of the decision and order, that the clerk's office was entitled to correct a clerical error without notice to the defendant in a hearing. And I understand in your argument, and I understood in your brief, that you acknowledge that it was error for the clerk to make this modification of the judgment. Is that correct?
Right. Our argument is inconsistent with the position that the trial court, the post-conviction court took?
It seems to me that if a modification was made without authority, that it's void from the beginning. The modification is void from the beginning.
The clerk's modification.
The clerk's modification is a legal nullity if there's no authority to do it. That, and so one way maybe of remedying it, if it is void from, if there's no legal authority to enter a modification of judgment, there is no modification of judgment. Therefore, a trial court can't rely on a modification of judgment. Rather, the court would have to procedurally, if it saw fit, to enter its own modification of judgment, because it can't rely on a modification that is done without authority because it is void. It's a legal nullity. How do you respond to that?
Well, if that were the case, then the oral pronouncement of sentence still controls, and I guess the court would have to, you would have to start from scratch, pretend the modification never took place, and then the court would have to consider the issue. And
could, it's your position that the court could do that, and could do that without hearing, and could it have the same result?
I think so.
Does the oral pronouncement, does that control even if the judge signs the judgment?
If the oral pronouncement is unambiguous, the oral pronouncement controls. If the oral pronouncement, and this is the State versus Brown, if the oral pronouncement is ambiguous, then you look at the whole record to determine what the actual intention of the judge was, because the sentencing judge's intention is what controls. And you could look at the written judgment of conviction in determining that, and in some cases, maybe the written judgment of conviction would control. But when the oral sentence is unambiguous, as it is here, that controls.
This would be a different case if you had an ambiguous trial court record.
Yes.
We're not dealing with that.
Right.
Could you tell me again on what authority you're conceding that the judge and not the clerk should have made this correction to the judgment?
I'm taking that position because the case law that I've seen in Wisconsin talks about the court having the power to correct clerical errors. It doesn't mention the clerk being able to do it, and also obviously these are not binding, but the most of the rules that I cited in the brief talk about the court having the power to do it.
But you're citing the federal rules, not state rules, right?
Not Wisconsin rules, federal and other
state
rules. Obviously, they're not binding on us, but the Wisconsin case law talks about the court.
And which cases would that be?
Well, there are a number of them cited. Page 23, I cite three different cases that talk about the power to correct clerical errors at any time.
But the statutes allow the judge or the clerk to sign a judgment of conviction, right?
Yes.
So why wouldn't, by implication, there be authority in the clerk to correct what was merely a clerical error? In this case, which has no impact on the bottom line, has no substantive impact whatsoever.
We just believe that it's appropriate practice to let the court review these issues, particularly if we're talking about a situation where the sentence may be impacted, as opposed to something where the parties would be indifferent.
But everybody concedes in this case that the sentence has not been impacted. This correction has no substantive impact.
Well, potentially it could be impacted. We agree that, in fact, there's no prejudice because the sentence the written judgment conviction accurately reflected what the oral pronouncement
was. Right, and this is a correction to make the judgment of conviction, the piece of paper, conform to the actual sentence that was pronounced at the time of the sentencing hearing. So it has no substantive impact. I mean, it's not just a harmless error analysis. It was a correction, a pure clerical correction that had no substantive impact on anybody's rights whatsoever.
I agree.
So why would we establish a rule that that cannot be done by the clerk, that that must be done by the court? Isn't that just sort of form over substance? Since there's nothing the defendant could have argued to change the situation in this case.
Well, this case, I think, is a pretty easy one to look at the result, but there are other cases where what is a clerical error and whether substantive rights are affected may be more difficult. And I think the clerks in some cases probably make the corrections themselves. In some cases, they probably send them to the courts. But it's maybe some of the other cases that would give a reason to require the courts to be involved in these initially.
Counsel, by what authority can a clerk sign a judgment?
Well, if you look at the civil rules, it says that the clerk can sign the judgment on order of the court.
It says 806.062, the judge, that's the civil case. And generally the rule is if there's nothing in the criminal case, the criminal rules of procedure, the civil rules apply.
Right, and it talks about the clerk being able to do it at the direction of the court.
Here's what it says. The judge, it says more than that, the judge or the clerk upon the written order of the court, of the judge, may sign the judgment. So where's the written order here?
If I could interject for a minute, the criminal rules of procedure
provide... It talks about the clerk or the judge. You're right, there's an inconsistency.
So where
there.
Is that? What section are we
it's
looking at?
It's 972.13(4).
That.
Which pertains to judgments of conviction. Judgments shall be in writing and signed by the judge or the clerk. It doesn't have it as a prerequisite the prior order, as in civil courts.
Right. I've interpreted that statute, and maybe we're interpreting it differently. I've interpreted it to mean that the clerk is only performing a ministerial duty and doing what the court is.
Right, reducing what the judge said orally from the bench to the written document which will be entered in the file. And this is all done electronically now, right?
I guess it is.
I think that's the issue that is perplexing me. Here we have, and I think opposing counsel stated that there wasn't anything that they could do other than to follow what the original oral judgment was. So could we live with a rule that says that, where there isn't any? Because you're saying that if it affected sentencing, then this couldn't affect the sentencing. And it seems to be somewhat difficult to... you're going to say, well, if it was Steve Smith, but it really was Steve Jones that was convicted, that is different than affecting the sentence, except you don't know. I mean, these are all, it may be a problem with that. It seems to me that the state, or at least an argument to be made, that the clerk should or does have that power, except in the situation where it could result in a change of the sentence. Would that be a fair way to put it? Or, see, when you're saying you always need the judge, that's what I'm trying to think how we would put this down or what we would say in what situation.
That might be an appropriate place to draw the line. Obviously, I'm aware of the administrative inconvenience of having the judge have to deal with a lot of very minor clerical errors that neither party cares about.
Well, but look, how do we know it will not affect sentencing? One side says that it's clear in the transcript. The other side says it isn't. Do we let the clerk decide that?
That's the problem.
That's the problem. The problem is after the fact, after the clerk does it, then you can say it does or doesn't affect it, but it takes a judge to say whether it does or doesn't affect it. Now, it's the 900 number and the 800 number both say a judgment can be signed by the judge or clerk, maybe under different circumstances. I don't see any statute that says that the, or case law that says that the clerk has the right to modify a judgment.
I did not find any either.
But there's case law that a judge can modify under certain circumstances. That's why you're saying it has to be done by a judge, if I understand your brief and argument.
That's right.
And that you get into a trap if you get into taking a hypothetical or proposal that Justice Wilcox says, because you don't know until after the fact, after a judge makes the decision. That it does or doesn't affect sentence.
I think it's clear from the record here that it does not affect the sentence in this particular case. But they were taking the position that it did. So where do you classify that one?
It does affect the sentence.
It has the potential to affect the sentence as opposed to a changing someone's middle initial.
When was it that the clerk modified the sentence?
The clerk, and incidentally, I talk in my brief sometimes about amended judgments of conviction, but the clerk's office would say this was a corrected judgment of conviction, and they make a distinction. They made the correction, I believe, in November of 1997, and then the procedure is that the Department of Corrections is notified, and then the Department of Corrections sends out a notice to everyone on the bottom of that little document that's in the appendix of the defendants, including the defendant.
I think what I'm getting at is, I think you used the word order somewhere in your argument about the judge convicting the defendant and imposing sentence and then ordering such and such to go into the judgment. It seems to me at that point the clerk, through error, modified the order, failed to follow the order. The one in 1997, I think you said, is really the true, correct embodiment of the judgment.
That's correct. The sentence was imposed and the judgment was imposed in 1976, and the written judgment of conviction didn't reflect the actual sentence.
If for example, the clerk had typed in or written in 90 life plus 90 years, that would be a modification of the judgment. Clear error out of the presence of the defendant. We'd be shocked and we'd want that corrected, right? I don't think counsel would permit that to stand.
The corrections can go the other way as well. I mean, sometimes the errors, the clerical errors, are to the detriment of the defendant. I would just briefly talk about Siegel versus State. It was mentioned by the defendant in his argument. We disagree as to the meaning of the case, but It should be noted that the Siegel Court concluded the court's final statement during the oral pronouncement of the sentence constituted the sentence that Siegel had to serve. And that is wholly consistent with the position we're taking here. We're contending the oral pronouncement of sentence was unambiguous and controls, and the correction was only made to bring the written judgment into conformity with that oral pronouncement, or as they say in discussing the court's authority to correct these clerical errors, to make the judgment speak the truth. Unless there are any other questions, that would conclude my argument.
Counsel, in 805.18, civil procedure on trials, that's the statute regarding mistakes and omissions, harmless error, I think, correcting the errors. Is there any that deals with trials? Does that apply in this case?
I don't know. I don't even know exactly what it says. We've argued in our brief that 971.26 is applicable, which is basically 971.26.
And what does that say? I mean, if you recall, I don't want to put you on the spot. Got it right here. Formal defects. That's what you're talking about.
Right.
Okay. And that's proceedings before and at trial. Is it your position that 971.26 then applies to both civil and criminal proceedings?
Yes.
Okay.
And it clearly applies in criminal cases. I mean, there are a number of cases, criminal cases, dealing with that particular statute.
And this would be a judgment. No judgment shall be affected by reason of any defect or imperfection in matters of form. Do not prejudice the defendant. That's
right.
Your argument.
Right.
Thank you. Mr. K. Do you want to get back this, or are you going to make other motions? Because you're going to lose on this one.
Well, whatever.
I mean, you concede you're going to lose at this one. I bet. Shouldn't put words in your mouth because you have to conform to the original transcript.
Right, but there's one other argument that could be made at the trial court level, and that is the 893.40 argument, which we cited in our preview. That's the statute of limitations. And it could be that counsel could argue that, trial counsel could argue that the statute of limitations bars changes or actions 20 years after the fact. This Department of Corrections memo and interplay between the clerk was more than 20 years after the fact, and it could be that the argument could be made, and the trial court may say that 20 years is too much, and that's not going to be something that the trial court would do. So there is that provision. It's not a new factor as a fact per se, but it's a new consideration as a matter of law.
Just think the department had to come in earlier if it's going to change that judgment.
Yes. And I think the practice is that once a person is sentenced to upon, that their sentencing transcript follows them. The department refers to the fact that they have the transcript, that they sent it back to the trial court clerk for clarification, so they had the transcript for some 20 years and chose not to review it until it's too late.
Did you make that argument in your motion papers? I just don't remember.
In my post-conviction motion, I'm not sure if we directly raised that. I think at that point we were just talking about the
Just wanted to get your foot in the door at that point. It's okay.
Isn't the flip side of your argument that the defendant really knew about this error for a long, long time and sat on his hands hoping that no one would correct it? Can't catch it.
Maybe, but I don't think that this defendant or most defendants in the system are that knowledgeable to go back and read a transcript and compare that lengthy document to a judgment of conviction and try to figure out the discrepancies. When they're there, they're staffed and they're told, this is your release date, this is where you're going to go, this is where you're going to be. And they, you know, listen to the correction officials' directions as to where they're going to be placed and what they're going to do with you. He followed the judgment of conviction just like they did.
Mr. K, isn't the first question that every defendant asks his defense attorney upon leaving the courtroom after sentencing, how much did I get? Yes, right.
Maybe. He could have asked that. I don't know.
How much did I get, especially in a complicated sentencing like this?
Maybe they figured it out. Oh. But
not to worry. Life plus.
And there is some case law in order to bolster what the Attorney General's office is indicating, and they acknowledge or recognize that they agree in theory to the fact that a judge should change things, not a clerk. But even the State versus Amos case talked about a situation where a defendant was brought back before the court and his judgment of conviction was modified to reduce the pre-sentence credit of some 270-odd days. So in effect, his sentence was increased by 270 days, which is far less than the 30 years. So I think there is some authority out there from case law to support the position that a judge should make these changes, and there should be a hearing when there's a substantial imposition of perceived time on the defendant. And lastly, I also want to indicate that I think this is a matter of statewide importance. If the Department of Corrections is sending memos to the clerks, and this is happening routinely, then I think there needs to be some clarification as to that practice not being perpetuated. So I think that if the court would rule in Mr. Priota's favor and issue some directory type language that in the future these kinds of requests should be only made to the circuit court judge, or that judge determine whether hearing and notice and all that other stuff is absolutely necessary. So, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Kay. Thank you, Mr. Wolford. And that concludes our hearing on 98-2260.